Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Liz Baltaro.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and it's nice to have you as a guest host again on the show today, Liz.
Thank you, Adam. On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Ronald Baer, Professor of Public Health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, about his perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine, The FDA and Graphic Cigarette Pack Warnings.
Yeah, this whole question, Liz, about what is legal and not legal to for the government to require product makers, even the most dangerous product when used as intended, cigarettes, for the American public is one that the courts have gotten into, and he has some great opinions. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Me too.
But first, we've got some interesting research that matters about anemia and the risk of dementia.
About meditation, which may help reduce smoking.
About the combination, perhaps a really deadly one, of a attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, texting, and driving.
And one of my favorite topics, chocolate, and how it may be helpful for elderly people.
Do we bring any samples today?
No, unfortunately,
we
didn't.
Oh, we can only talk about it.
I know.
Well, let's talk then about our very first research study that has to do with anemia and the risk of dementia. And this was an article appropriately named in the journal Neurology.
So this included about 2,500 people ages 70 to 79, and they screened them to find that about 400 of them roughly were anemic. And
low blood counts.
Right. That just means they have low red blood cells.
Low blood is how my patients tell it to me.
Low blood. And they studied them and found that they were at a 41% higher risk of developing dementia when compared to people that were not anemic with normal blood counts.
And in and of itself, one might say, well, that study doesn't prove that the anemia caused the dementia, and it doesn't. But on the other hand, we sometimes see as doctors, Liz, that sometimes we see our patients have, we say a little bit of anemia, a touch of anemia. And the question is, is that harmless?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I do see a lot of, especially elderly patients and patients that are in the age that they studied that do have anemia. And I think oftentimes it's not something that's really worked up and looked into. And this study really suggests that that's something we should be looking at and trying to find the cause of.
Yeah, I think this is one that has more research coming, and it doesn't mean that you should take iron supplements necessarily without your doctor's advice if you're anemic. But if you are anemic, ask your doctor why, and it is worthwhile. I agree with you about maybe doing a workup just to try to find out. Let's talk about our very next research that matters in light of particularly our guest today, and this is meditation as a way of helping reduce smoking.
So this was a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and they used 60 college students, so it was a small study, and it included about half of them that were smokers. They did some integrative body-mind training. Boy, would I like to be a part of that, actually, and know what that means more. But in this study that came out of Oregon, they trained the students how to practice meditation and self-relaxation. And at the end of the study, the part of the group that smoked 60% less than they did at the beginning of the study. I thought this was so fascinating, Adam. I, first of all, love research studies about meditation and mind-body medicine. I think it's just fascinating to find out that there are a lot of physiological effects that happen when we can train ourselves to do self-calming techniques.
I couldn't agree with you more, Liz. This is really interesting. And what is even more interesting, though, in some respects, is that they compared this integrative mind-body training with just a general relaxation group. And the general relaxation group did not show much effect. And so the question is, what is it about the integrative mind-body aspect Because even those smokers who cut down weren't really aware that they had cut down as much as they did when they were measured. And so, and then can you be trained to do this really easy? Because I've seen this in research studies, but when they try to move this into a practice setting so that everyone can do it, it doesn't end up happening like this. And so most people don't get the effects that you see here. I don't know. What do you think? Think we could teach everyone to do this?
I'd like to think that we would have some ability to be able to teach this. I mean, I think you're right. Maybe in a busy doctor's office, we wouldn't have the time and we wouldn't have the training to really be able to do this effectively. But maybe maybe a psychologist or some counselors could be people that we could send our patients to.
Yeah, I think this is one more kind of tool in that toolkit to help people quit smoking, which is sometimes really hard. And maybe even this may work for other forms of substance abuse. That, to me, could be really exciting.
That's very compelling.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Liz, which is, I think, really compelling. And this is this whole question of teens that are just starting to drive, who may be texting, and then what if they also have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Oh, my goodness.
And this really affects you, doesn't it?
Well, I think it affects all families who have teenagers.
Right?
And what to do to try to help, because that's such a risky time. Just a new driver is risky. Then you throw in medications and conditions that are common. And texting, which is really common, not just for teens, even adults.
No, that's true. So this study was from the JAMA Pediatrics Journal, where they studied actually two groups. So they studied groups of new drivers that did not have ADHD, and they also studied groups of drivers that did have ADHD on and off of their medications. And they used a simulator driving track where they would introduce some unexpected obstacles in each round. And the subjects went through three of these driving simulations, and they were also given tasks to text and also allowed to talk on a hands-free phone set and on a hands phone set. And throughout all this, they observed that texting had the greatest effect in both groups, but in the ADHD group, they really were spending a lot of time outside of their lane margins in the simulated course. That's scary to me.
Yeah, it was like up to almost 3.5% of the time. So we said on a 20-minute drive, there could be a significant amount of that time, you know, 2 or 3 minutes or 1 to 2 minutes where the teens could be driving outside lanes. And this just tells us the perils of texting and driving, and also the perils of perhaps people, particularly our newest drivers, needing to make sure if they have ADHD that maybe they are on their medicines when they're driving.
That's a good point, Adam.
Well, let's talk very briefly about our last research that matters, about one of our favorite ones. And when Christy Page is here, it's one of her favorite research studies, anything to do with chocolate, if it's a good outcome. What do we find here? What's the take-home research finding here?
So also from the Journal of Neurology, they recruited 60 elderly subjects, and they were given, they were both given chocolate drinks, but one of them was flavanol rich and one of them was flavanol poor. And interestingly enough, the subjects that had difficulty, so they had a reduced blood flow to their brains and they had difficulty to begin with in doing the cognitive tasks, after drinking either beverage, so it didn't matter if it was flavanol rich or not, either chocolate, any kind of chocolate, for that group actually allowed more blood flow to their brains and better cognitive performance.
So 2 cups of cocoa a day seems like it may help the doctor stay away. I love it. It's a great, simple take-home message here. And I think as far as our research that matters, that's one maybe people can remember, as well as not texting and driving, about meditation and
about
cigarettes.
Anemia increasing the dementia risk.
Well, we're going to take a short break. That'll conclude the research that matters. But when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Ronald Baer, professor of public health at Columbia University in the Mailman School of Public Health, about his article in the New England Journal of Medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. Today on Conversations, Liz, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ronald Bayer, professor of public health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, about his recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine dealing with graphic warnings on tobacco products.
Welcome, Dr. Bayer. Thank you for being with us today.
So pleased to be with you, Adam and Liz.
So one thing I was wondering, Dr. Bayer, what prompted you to write that article for the New England Journal last year?
Well, you know, as someone involved in public health and in public health policy, I have been interested in tobacco and smoking for years, and I've been interested in it for an obvious reason. Smoking kills more, you know, huge numbers of people, estimated 400,000 a year in the U.S., and I've been interested in the way in which public health has tried to go at the problem. And, you know, there have been many, many approaches, raising cigarette taxes, restricting smoking in indoor settings and now outdoor settings. But one of the things that has been very interesting to me is how we have handled the issue of tobacco advertising in the U.S. The U.S. is actually very interesting when compared to other democratic countries. I mean, we protect advertising as a kind of speech, which, you know, we take it for granted that that's the way it is all over. But the fact is that in most other democratic countries, advertising is considered a kind of commercial activity, not a kind of speech. So I actually found that, you know, some years ago there was an effort in Massachusetts to limit public advertising of cigarettes within a certain number of feet of schools, and the Supreme Court basically threw it out, and it said this violated the First Amendment. So I've been interested in knowing what the why we are different and what the consequences are for public health. And then, you know, tobacco policy has gotten much, much more aggressive under the Obama administration. Recent legislation, well, a couple of years ago, legislation giving the FDA authority to regulate tobacco is very, very important.
Well, Dr. Bayer, before we get too much further, let's take a quick kind of overview. When we talk about really the advertising and your particular research, what we're really talking about is not necessarily fully the content of what the tobacco industry puts on their ad, but a public health ad,
right,
and the warnings. Help us understand, what is the existing warning system in the United States? Because that's critically important to understanding where we're at and do we need to change?
Right. Well, you know, the existing warning system actually goes back to the 1960s when these rather innocuous messages were posted on cigarette packs and on ads themselves. It said, warning, the Surgeon General has found X, Y, or Z. Originally, cigarette smoking may be harmful to your health. With years, some of those messages have gotten larger, and they've gotten less ambiguous. So that's what we have. The problem is that almost everyone agrees that the messages that now appear on cigarette packs, either on the side of the pack or on the bottom of the pack, are barely seen. The language which is used is they are invisible. Not that they aren't printed in black and white, but no one sees them. They have no impact. They don't warn people. They don't educate people. They don't encourage people to stop. They just occupy space. So from a public health point of view, the warnings we now have are basically, I would say, a sop to the industry. We're doing our warnings, and now people make the choices in light of all the evidence.
Yeah, I have a patient who once said, because now there are several different warnings, and she said, well, don't worry, I don't smoke those cigarettes that contain carbon monoxide, because that's one of the warnings. But they're, you know, so thinking, oh, only that pack contains the carbon monoxide.
Right, right. You know, this has been, you know, troubling because, although the warnings on packages are really, and everyone knows this, is one of the weakest pieces of tobacco control efforts. We now, in New York City, it now costs $13, $14 to buy a pack of cigarettes because of cigarette taxes. And the taxes are so high, not as a way of raising money to pay for education or whatever. It's a way of discouraging people, and that's very, very effective. So, in fact, the warning piece of the tobacco control, which was actually the first thing we did in the U.S., is the weakest link. And I think it's the fact that it's the weakest link and the fact that it becomes increasingly critical to stop people from smoking, to warn people about smoking, that public health people have begun to say there must be a better way.
Yeah, Dr. Baer, I was actually thinking about recently when I was in Mexico coming back from working with a group of medical students there in the airport, I noticed right away the cigarette packages having a huge warning on them that said in very bold black letters, smoking kills. It took up, I think, at least a third of the front face of each packet. Right. And I'm not a smoker, and I normally don't pay attention to, I normally don't notice any of the warnings that you're speaking of, and I wouldn't have even been able to tell you what they were. So that was really striking and really reinforces to me that it is, like you say, a really weak link that we have on our tobacco labels in this country. So tell me a little bit about what was the ruling that was made a year ago that you wrote about so that our listeners can kind of better understand this issue?
The Federal Food and Drug Administration basically proposed to require tobacco companies to have warning that occupied basically half the pack, and that
half the pack, wow,
and that basically included one of several messages, and included a graphic picture. When the courts began to consider this issue, the question was: were we requiring tobacco companies to post a message against the industry, what they said, on their own dime? That is, if the government wants to post messages about the dangers of tobacco, if it wants to have big posters and ads in convenience shops or in drugstores warning about smoke, government can do whatever it wants. But the government should not be able, the tobacco industry said, to make us use half of our pack to warn people about smoking, which is really counter-advertising against our product. So that was their first argument. And then the second argument was, not only can't the government make us carry a warning on our packages, which basically seeks to discourage, but that these are not informational. It'd be one thing if the tobacco, if the warnings, like when you buy iodine, or there are many products you can buy that said this product is poison, whatever, it's information. What the tobacco industry argued was that we were not only trying to inform people, which might be legitimate under First Amendment notions, truth in advertising, but we're trying to grip people. We're trying to push them, nudge them into giving up tobacco, giving up cigarettes, and that, the tobacco industry argued, was a violation of the First Amendment.
Well, and isn't it true, we do know that advertising that really elicits this negative emotional feeling for cigarettes consumption does cause people to quit, which are these really graphic warnings. So there is a little bit of truth that it isn't just informing, because everyone knows cigarettes are deadly. It is this pushing, is it? So there is some truth in that, isn't there?
There is, and that's the paradox, it seems to me.
Well, we're gonna need to take a short break, Dr. Baer, but when we return, we're going to continue this conversation about these graphic warnings on tobacco products and what it means for the future of public health and the number one preventable cause of death in the United States. We'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Baer, when we return, we'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. Today, we've been talking with Dr. Ronald Baer about new graphic cigarette warning labels and the Supreme Court's ruling in favor of the tobacco companies to not have to provide these labels on their packages. Dr. Baer.
Liz, actually, let me correct you, okay? I'm sorry.
No, please do.
What happened was, two different appeals courts in the United States ruled on these graphic warnings, and one court ruled in favor of them, and one court ruled against them. That meant that the stage was set for going to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court had to resolve this this conflict. Ultimately, the Attorney General's office, which has to make these decisions on the behalf of the U.S. government, decided not to go to the Supreme Court with an appeal because they calculated and they believed that if they went to the Supreme Court, they would probably lose. And rather than lose this case, they felt they could go back to the drawing board and make the messages and the scientific justification for the messages stronger, so that if they had to go ahead to the Supreme Court, they had a, would have a better chance of succeeding. The problem, of course, is that going back to the drawing board, starting all over again with the messages, both the text messages and the graphic warnings, will take time. And that's years in which effective, fear-inducing advertising designed to discourage smoking will be off the drawing board. And I think that is a tragic mistake for the U.S., especially since, you know, if you travel in Europe, if you travel to Australia, if you travel across the border to Canada, these things are commonplace now.
So let me ask you a question, Dr. Baer. Given the fact that many other countries around the world, even many of the countries from the former Soviet Union, have very effective large warnings that discourage consumption, what could the Food and Drug Administration done differently, or what should they do differently moving forward to advance their interest, but also that will pass mustered with the court systems?
Right. And I would add, pass our support our interest as public health people concerned about the toll of cigarette smoking. I don't know. I mean, I think that when the Food and Drug Administration, guided by the Attorney General, decided not to go to the Supreme Court, the general position was, we have to rethink our strategy. No one ever wanted to admit this represented a defeat. They talked about it as a strategic move. Now, of course, a strategic move is not quite a defeat, but neither is it a success. So what people in the tobacco control community are saying is that we need better science, not on whether these graphic warnings are seen and can be recalled, but a better warnings on how and which ways they actually reduce tobacco consumption. And I have been actually told by some people I interviewed when I was writing this article for the New England Journal that, well, actually the science could have been better, the studies could have been better, they were rushed. I think that's all a little bit of hogwash. I think the fact is, there was hope against hope that the court system wouldn't do what it did, and we now confront a situation in the United States where, because commercial speech has protection, it's extremely difficult, and has gotten more difficult over the years, to pass legislation or enact regulations that restrict advertising without crossing the line that says this is a violation of the First Amendment. So yes, it will. The question is, what will change the story? Well, I think two or three judges in the majority retiring from the Supreme Court, which is unlikely, would help. The conservative majority of the court it is interesting. Justice Thomas, who is among the most conservative on the court and the most willing to tolerate government interventions in some areas, is, when it comes to First Amendment rights of advertisers, a kind of, he's like Thomas Jefferson or something. And I think it's tragic. I think that we have elevated commercial speech into something it is not, never. And by the way, the notion that advertising is a kind of freedom of speech issue only became law in the United States, case law, Supreme Court law, in the 1970s. Before that, advertising was always treated as commercial activity that could be regulated by the legislature or by regulatory bodies without any question. And if you look at a finance page and you see advertising for stocks and bonds, you see what is called tombstone advertising. That is, it's a picture of the bond with the fact, nothing but the fact, you know, the interest earned, sponsoring agencies, whatever. You cannot legally advertise in a commercially exciting way bonds and stocks in the United States. But those rules were put into place many, many years ago before the Supreme Court created this doctrine of commercial speech. So we're in a fix, and it's not simply the issue of tobacco. If you wanted to restrict advertising for high-calorie, high-fat, high-fructose product. Exactly the same problem, because the law in the United States, and again, we tend to think of, well, that's what makes America great. We have a democracy where even the worst things can be said, and the best way to confront bad speech is more speech and better speech.
Wow, you're making so many compelling points about the advertising system in our country. Right. I'm wondering, given, and I appreciate your clarification about what the situation was with the Supreme Court,
sure,
and that they haven't really made a ruling, given the current situation and where it stands, how do you see behavioral science helping push forward smoking prevention? Mm-hmm. Where can we go from here to make the best out of what's happened?
Well, moving on the advertising front is going to be extremely difficult. And the question is it worth our time and effort when there are other things that can be done? There is one other strategy that's been adopted in a number of places that's fairly controversial, that I actually have written about recently, and that is the decision to ban smoking in parks and on beaches. That is to say that we want to make large areas of our public space smoke-free. It's controversial because the science behind banning smoking on a beach, imagine smoke, I don't know what the case is in North Carolina. I can't believe there are bans on smoking on the Outer Banks. But in New York City, you cannot smoke in Central Park, and you cannot smoke at Coney Island. You can't smoke at the beach. It's against the law. And that's true in about 150 beaches across the country and several hundred parks. And this is important because it's part of a process of what people in tobacco control call denormalization. That is, making cigarettes something which used to be normal, conventional, and turning them into something which is unpleasant, weird, unacceptable. And that move, which public health people have been pushing, but they've been pushing it in a way that isn't quite honest about why they're pushing.
Well, in North Carolina, there are some beaches that actually have adopted this, and it's really done under the auspices of local regulation, local control, which is a hallmark of most conservative state legislatures, except when it comes up to tobacco issues at times, and then it becomes an issue, we shouldn't have local control, we only should have a state law. But that's legislation that predominantly is pushed by the tobacco industry. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good talking to both.
Thank you, doctor. We've been talking with Dr. Baer about his recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine about cigarette graphic warnings. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have questions you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Liz, we've got some great house call questions today about a condition called interstitial urethritis.
About the expense of a neck surgery.
About what if you hear a heart murmur or you have an undiagnosed heart condition.
And about chondrocalcinosis.
That's a difficult word to say, and too many letters for Scrabble.
That's right.
We'll ask our great executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today.
I am young, 32 years old, and it burns a great deal when I urinate. I got tested several times for a bladder infection, but the urine cultures always come back negative. A new doctor told me it was probably not an infection, but interstitial urethritis. I never heard of that before. I tried to make an appointment to see a urologist, but the office said that they did not treat this condition. What do I do?
Oh, first off, I'm so sorry. This is a frustrating condition. I will say that.
Absolutely. And it's called actually interstitial cystitis. So just for clarification, and it is very frustrating. And I've actually had several patients who I think this is what's going on. The frustrating part is that we don't really understand what causes it. Isn't that right, Adam?
Yes, and it's frequently misdiagnosed. So because the symptoms, having to go to the bathroom a lot and sometimes burning when you urinate, people think, oh, that's a urinary tract infection. And the difference here is that the urine cultures are usually negative here. And so people get treated with antibiotics, but they don't really get better. And it's then a difficult diagnosis to make. And it's the history here, which is negative urine cultures and frequently having to go to the bathroom and it burning when you pee.
Mm-hmm, that's true. And I thought that you could see a urologist with this condition, but certainly this condition can be managed by your primary care doctor as well.
Yeah, a lot of people increasingly think of this condition now as an inflammatory condition. Sometimes even a chronic bladder pain condition. And so maybe some doctors are uncomfortable treating for chronic pain because that's what this can be. And whether it's with an anti-inflammatory medication or even something stronger or meditation or other forms of treating chronic pain, that's what it probably will take.
Mm-hmm. Shall we move to our next house call?
Let's listen to it, Erica.
My husband had neck surgery recently for a herniated disc. When he checked into the hospital, they said it was going to be $89,000, and we had to put down 24% deposit. Are they crazy? I had insurance, and they eventually settled for a fraction of that amount, and we only had to put down $3,500. I appreciate your thoughts.
Oh my. Well, this is a challenging one. Another question so commonly about our rising healthcare costs and all that surrounds it.
And I know this came from a listener outside of our local region, but I think the cost of surgeries are so expensive, the cost of hospitalizations of what is really required. And so having a patient have to put down such a large amount of money, which most patients don't have that kind of cash lying around. And frequently, the insurance companies actually aren't going to pay $89,000. They may actually only pay a fraction of that, $10,000, $15,000. So it's confusing, and you're vulnerable at this time right before surgery.
Do you think that they were going to get that money back, Adam? Was it like a payment up front that they would get reimbursed back once the insurance?
Well, I think that there's some concern. You know, you go to put a new roof on your house.
Right.
They want half the money down payment before they put that new roof on your house. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a down payment and a realistic amount beforehand. But realizing that if you have insurance, it's going to be reimbursed. And then most of what you bill may not get actually reimbursed. So I think it's a complicated issue that we're going to be talking about more and more, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's true.
Thank you for sharing your story. I know a lot of listeners will understand and empathize. Erica, what's our very next house call?
If someone had an undiagnosed heart condition, would lab work show that there's a possible heart problem?
Oh, boy. Well, yes and no. It depends what heart problem. It depends.
It really does. And clearly, our questioner here has some concerns. Mm-hmm. And so I think both Liz and I would want to know, well, what are those concerns to start with that have you worried about a heart condition? Because a lot of times the laboratory is the last step in that process, not the first. The first is a good history.
Right.
So what types of things, Liz, what do you think of when someone might find a lab? What are you thinking of?
Well, I was thinking about measuring, for example, cardiac enzymes, yeah, which is basically something that's released from the heart cells when they're dying. So that's something that's released during a heart attack or anything that's kind of toxic to the heart cells that causes them to die. And then they release their contents into the bloodstream. And that's
measured. Or if they have heart failure.
Right.
Yeah, so those are kind of the late stages there. The early stages... there's a test called a C-reactive protein for inflammation in the body, but it's not one we usually order. You know, occasionally you could do an ultrasound of the heart, but again, these are expensive tests. I'd start with that history and then move on to the physical. And as my great teacher used to tell me, if you still haven't figured it out, repeat your history and physical.
Right. Well, and then there's imaging studies of the heart too, so... That sounds like good advice.
Hopefully, though, some thoughts on that, and thank you for sharing that question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
What is chondrocalcinosis? I was told I had that when my knee swelled up recently and I went to the doctor. He said it was just arthritis, but I'm confused.
Well, you probably wouldn't be alone. I bet there's a fair number of doctors who are a little bit confused when they see that on a report because we don't see it that often, but we do see it.
Mm-hmm, that's true. So chondrocalcinosis, which is a mouthful, is a big name for what is we also call pseudo-gout.
So sometimes you have gout in that joint where the joint swells up, and that's uric acid crystals in the joint. In this particular case, you can get calcium deposits in the joint. And so if the doctor does an injection or tries to take some fluid out, they'll look for those calcium deposits and kind of diagnose it. So it acts like gout, but it really isn't gout.
Right. That's a good point. And the good news is that there are treatments for this, and there is a lot that can be done to alleviate the pain.
Yeah, we treat it kind of like we do arthritis mm-hmm. in a joint, but it can sometimes be a little bit more resistant. And so I think if your doctor says you have chondrocalcinosis, and we'll ask our health sciences librarians to put up some nice information and some links about this, and you can explore it further. Because you should understand it, and there are a few things that you might do differently. Well, that'll conclude our research, or really our house call segment of the show today, as well as the show in general. We've had a good chance to talk about not only the chondrocalcinosis.
Also about heart conditions and if there's labs that can show that.
About maybe the future of healthcare becoming a little more transparent about these hospital bills and what should be expected.
And about the difficulties in treatment of interstitial cystitis.
Well, thank you for joining us for today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu, and you can visit us online and follow us in all kinds of ways.
We'd like to thank you, and we'd also like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship and our guest today, Dr. Baer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We look forward to talking with you next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.